Welcome back to Mike and Dan versus the Internet. I am not Mike. It's been a little while since we've had episode 3, but we're moving forward now at a pretty good pace. This episode is a pretty special one. It is with the amazing podcaster Roy Field Brown. You can listen to his shows like Mid-Atlantic or Friday 15 or How Jamaica Conquered the World or a fantastic show that he produces and I was fortunate enough to be a guest voice on, 10 American Presidents. Go listen to them on the podcatcher of your choice. You're listening to this one right here on iTunes, so go give them some love. Not that they need it, but he's part of the Agora Podcast Network and is absolutely wonderful. Go give him a listen. You can follow him on Twitter. He is at Royfield, R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D. Coming up soon, we're going to have some fantastic interviews at a Comic-Con. And Mike and Dan will be coming to you again soon in the next week because we have enough backlog of material now that if I edit things in a timely fashion, you'll get it fast. So listen to Royfield as I call him on Skype. Hello, Royfield.
Hello, how are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you for doing this with me again.
No worries. Listen, the very first time I interviewed somebody for my How Jamaica Conquered the World podcast, half of it didn't record. So trust me. I know how these things can go, so it's totally fine.
I didn't even realize it until a few days later when I went to start go editing, and I'm like, oh no, where is it? It just came out as a bleep. So thanks for joining me once again. As the listeners of my show don't quite realize yet, you and I have already talked. We've already spoken about a month ago.
I've forgotten all about it. You ask me the same questions, you'll get fresh, new, spontaneous answers. Not jaded, old. Don't worry.
Excellent. So we are talking today on Mike and Dan versus the Internet with Royfield Brown. He is a raconteur of the podcasting world. He is the host of Friday 15, which is a brilliant new show. 10 American Presidents, the newest episode just dropped, all about President Grant. Mid-Atlantic, How Jamaica Conquered the World. Royfield, how do you do it all?
I've got a short attention span. Nobody wants to work with me. I'm unemployable. All those things conspire to make me the podcast scatterbrain that I am.
Well, I would argue with no one wants to work with you because you've had on your various shows, specifically with 10 American Presidents and Friday 15 Mid-Atlantic, some giants in the podcasting world. You've had Dan Carlin and Mike Duncan from History of Rome. You talk to John Elledge all the time. And for me, in my world, he's pretty big.
Well, you know what? John will be pretty excited to know that he's big in somebody's world. But the lesson of that is, you know what? Just go and ask people. You know, there's no real secret behind it. There is, you know, the word community gets bandied around a lot. And there isn't really a podcasting community outside of those kind of Slate and NPR shows. And by that, what I mean is whereby people have all worked with each other before and kind of know each other. The very nature of podcasting is that it can be quite a solitary thing. So, you know, you look at what other people are doing, and let's take Dan Carlin as an example, and you can think, well, you know, he's established and if I ask him if he'll work with me, he'll probably say no. But you know what? If you don't ask, you definitely won't work with him. So the lesson is just go and ask these people, whether it's your Dan Carlings or your Mike Duncans, et cetera, or whoever your podcasting hero is. Hey, can I have you on my show? Could we collaborate on this? And you know what? You've got a 50-50 chance. They'll not end up saying yes.
Well, that's a great way of looking at it. That's actually how we got you. I just decided, I got to ask him if we can get him on.
I'm cheap. You know, I'll work with anyone and turn up to anyone.
I'm not sure if that, so. Which of those that makes sound worse at the moment. So, let me get into 10 American Presidents for a moment. Your Ulysses S. Grant episode just came out, and I got to be a guest voice on that. So thank you very much for that.
You were rather good, but you've got this whole kind of dramatic diction thing down pat. So props to you, sir.
Well, thank you. So how did you decide that you wanted to do an entire series on the American presidents, being that you yourself are, well, a subject of Her Majesty the Queen?
Yes, and you got that right. I'm not a British citizen, I'm a subject. I fell in love with American history relatively late. Ever since I was a little boy, I've been really into history. But it was a very Eurocentric / black view of history. So my parents are from the island of Jamaica, though I was born in the UK. So my history upbringing was British-centric, then Euro-centric, but then with elements of the Caribbean and the black experience as it comes out of Africa. A lot of Europeans, whether it's intellectually or culturally, kind of dismiss America historically as being a place with little history, and also that and ultimately historical roots, if you take the Native Americans out of it, are all kind of European anyway. So there's a certain amount of intellectual snobbery about studying American history within Europe, and I definitely fell into that camp, thinking, well, this is nouveau country, it can't teach us anything, etc. It was only when I traveled for the first time to the United States in 1996 that I kind of really understood the true size and actual complexity of the country. And I think us as Brits and as Europeans, we don't appreciate how complex culturally America actually is, let alone its history. And then funnily enough, I learned a lot about American history but by actually going to Canada. Two of my children actually live in Canada. They relocated there 10 years ago. And going to Canada and understanding this is America, which never turned its back on the UK, you learn a lot about America. And it always fascinates me how Americans have this blind spot towards Canada. Because, you know, part of the myth that you tell yourselves is that every American wanted to rail against King George and his terrible taxes, but actually one-fifth of Americans didn't, and they all moved to Canada. And that's the reason why Canada is an English-speaking country, not a French-speaking country, just north of the border, because all these American loyalists went there. So America, North America, is this fascinating European experiment. And when you understand that it is an experiment in a way that France is not an experiment or Germany, you know, you're German or you're French, you live in this area defined as Germany and France, and you just are German or French. But America is something really weird and different in terms of there's a set of ideals, there's a constitution, there are these national myths and whatever, and these founding fathers that created this country. There's a lot to be in awe of. So that's how I fell in love with doing, being in love with American history, and then fell into doing 10 American Presidents.
It's definitely myths that we do like to tell ourselves, and we certainly are a country that's held together by shared ideals to one extent or another that really go with the thought and the concept of all men are created equal. And I mean, it's certainly what I was brought up with. My family had immigration in the not too distant past, all post-World War I, fleeing the Austro-Hungarian Empire is where my family came from.
Whereabouts in the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
In the country that is now called Slovenia.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Which I have about a quarter of my genetic makeup is Slovenian, so I have a little bit in common with the new First Lady of the United States. So,
Gladbach. That's what it used to be called, Slovenia. The German name for Slovenia was Gladbach.
I never knew that.
Yep. and it has, there's still a very small Slovenian speaking population in Austria. That bit of Europe is incredibly interesting because you go to Slovenia and it feels very Italian in terms of the architecture. So it's kind of part of a greater kind of cultural Italy, and I had a rather beautiful holiday there, actually on the Croatian coast in a place called Istria, which is just to the south of Slovenia, about 7 years ago. It's an amazingly beautiful place, and it's completely at the kind of the cockpit of the Adriatic. It's right at the north there, and it's where Germanic Europe ends and where the Latin bit of Europe starts, but also where Slavic bit of Italy, of Europe starts as well. It's an incredibly fascinating bit of Europe.
Oh, absolutely. To that point, my great-grandfather, who emigrated here in, was it 1914, 1915, because he didn't want to get pulled into the Emperor's army, the village he was from crossed into several different regions. He would cross into Italy, cross into more German-speaking areas. And so he had to be able to get by with a little bit of Italian, a little bit of German, a little bit of English, and then also his own Slovenian. And being that it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a very German, let's say German-accented, if nothing else, a version of Slovenian is what he spoke. So that when my grandfather went back to Slovenia in the late 70s or early 80s, when it was still behind the Iron Curtain, a lot of the residents there thought he might have been on the younger side of being a German soldier, maybe like in the HJ or something, because the Slovenian that he spoke, and he spoke fluent Slovenian, was German accented. And he used certain words that everyone else didn't use anymore.
There's also in that little bit of, just in the province over, so in Alto Adige, of the South Tyrol, there is this really unique amalgam of German and Italian called Ladin. And, you know, it just goes to show how incredibly complex that bit of Europe actually is, because you really are getting to the very edge of the Germanic speaking world and where the Latin world starts. And I think there's only something like about 30 or 40,000 people that speak Ladin in the South Tyrol. You know, in Italy, but it's this language which is kind of dying out. And yes, you're completely right, because so many language groups overlap there. You know, people are bilingual, trilingual, or at least can make themselves understood in one or two or, you know, three different languages.
Oh, absolutely. And just in that area, it's, to your point, a melting pot of language. One of the podcasts I'm listening to is the History of English podcast. And
oh, it's a brilliant show.
And the early episodes are all about, well, as you know, but for the rest of our listeners, the Proto-Indo-European languages of, here's how Sanskrit and German and English and Italian and French and a few others all have common roots. And you're like, what? That's insane. But it is just pretty amazing.
Well, you do know that Kevin came on my show as well.
No, I did not.
He did an episode called The President's Speech, which
I'm sorry, for 10 American Presidents. Yes, I did listen to that one, yes.
You see, I've worked with all the greats, Daniel.
Oh my gosh, you certainly do. But I cut you off right there because I was acting like it's a regular conversation and not an interview. So, please tell a little bit more for the folks on my side what that was all about.
So when I came up with the idea of 10 American Presidents, I thought there's going to be 10 episodes. I've marched through the 10 presidents who I think are the most significant in American history that don't just tell us about their presidency, but also will illuminate pivotal points of American history. Cutting a long story short, after doing the episode with Dan Carlin, I realized that I'd be selling myself short if I only put out 10 episodes. So it's been a little bit of an exercise in terms of looking at different aspects of American culture, American history. And one of the things which kind of has always fascinated me is American English, and the traditional view that us Brits have is that you guys speak funny and we speak properly. And actually, the truth of the matter is, as far as linguists are concerned, it's the other way around. American English is much truer to the British English spoken in the 16th, 17th, 18th century before you guys turned traitor and ditched the crown. And actually, us Brits went through a language, an accent shift in about the 1820s. So if you look at American history that way, I thought it was kind of really interesting to look at how American English and American presidents have actually affected the language. And like you, I'd always been totally in awe of the History of English podcast. Kevin is just an amazing storyteller and historian, and has the ability to take a very complex topic, you know, how language is formed and how we understand speech today through our native language of English, but make it accessible. So I wanted to work with him after I watched the King's Speech. And you've got, you know, King George VI wanting, you know, he's got a terrible stutter and he needs to be able to be monarchical by giving these addresses. And he can't. He's incredibly shy and he stutters terribly. And how, through a vocal coach, and he learns the ability to be able to deliver these speeches which can rouse a nation going through war, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, wouldn't it be quite great to work with Kevin and do the president's speech? And then you learn so many things, like George Washington was the first person documented to use the expression cane row. Good to the last drop comes from Teddy Roosevelt, etc., etc. But also, you know, the majesty of something like Lincoln's address, you know, and the fact that actually he thought that his Gettysburg address, he thought that was a failure at the time. He's one of the most stirring bits of American prose ever committed. And there was the guy who was seen as the ultimate American president who held the country together, thinking that was a failure. And, you know, I'm just absolutely blessed that I can work with people that A, know this stuff, and then help me seem good by telling me about it.
Especially with the American Presidents series or Jamaica Conquering the World, it's stuff that genuinely matters to people. And then when you have Mid-Atlantic, it's up to the moment, or at least up to the last 2 weeks, politics. So it's stuff that genuinely matters to people.
Well, I'm super lucky in that I can articulate things that I'm interested in. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I love history, so I do some history podcasts. I'm British, but I'm a Jamaican parented, so I do How Jamaica Conquered the World. I love politics, so I do Mid-Atlantic. You know, there's other things that I do besides. And I just see it as I'm just incredibly lucky that I can talk about this stuff. And there's just about a few people that are interested in what I do and actually want to hear more. You know, so I never kind of take all that stuff for granted, but, you know, I just see myself as, you know, lucky, really.
Well, absolutely. And because it matters to you, that comes across to the audience. It's much in the same way as a stand-up comic or a playwright. The advice is always write what you know, or tell the joke about what you know. If you write to what you think the audience wants, it's going to be hollow. Whereas if it's coming from your own experience, the more specific it is, weirdly enough, that makes it more universal.
I think you're completely right. And I have a few criticisms with podcast output. And one of them is that people just aren't brave enough. And what I mean by that is in terms of finding a topic which is new, mm-hmm. and or you've put your own personal slant on it. I'm intensely proud of How Jamaica Conquered the World, because there was no book to go and read about that. There are some academic studies about the cultural overreach of the island of Jamaica. There are. But, you know, you are looking at the influence of reggae on Western popular music, which is much more profound and deep than most people realize. For argument's sake, what is the key African-American cultural musical form of the last 60 years? What would you say, Daniel?
I would say rock and roll or jazz.
Well, let's say hip hop. Let's be specific. Hence, I said like the last 50, 60 years. So it's hip hop. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. That musical form would not exist without the island of Jamaica, without reggae. The first person who's seen as the grandfather of hip hop, called DJ Herc, was a Jamaican immigrant in the Bronx. What he decided to do when he came over as a teenager was to become a DJ in the Bronx, playing reggae records. And African Americans just couldn't get their heads around it. So what he did, he took that same DJing sensibility, but played soul records. And he cut those records up and DJed in such a way, which was very Jamaican, but with African-American R&B Motown records of the time. Then what he would do and get other people to do is announce those records. And the next record is X and Y and Z. And then they would talk over the record. So obviously, previous to that, you had DJs, radio DJs, and the next record is. But they continue to talk over the records. These are all Jamaican and West Indian immigrants. We call that toasting in Jamaica. In America, you call it rap. Hence, hip hop was born. So there was all this stuff about the island of Jamaica, whether it's musically or whether why is it that Usain Bolt was the most popular sportsman in the world? And one of the reasons is because he's not American. Okay, that the island of Jamaica, in lots of ways, he's seen as non-threatening. So you can have this popular sportsman, and half his popularity is based around the island. But there is not a book about it. There, you know, and I went off, and because of my innate knowledge and my innate love of my Jamaican heritage, put that thing together. And whilst I love podcasts about antiquity, about Greece and about Rome, there's only so many more of those podcasts I can actually listen to. You know, those podcasts, you know, Mike Duncan has done the definitive Roman podcast, as far as I'm concerned. So if you're going to come along and do another podcast about Rome, you best bring your absolute A game. And at the very least, do a sideways glance at the history of Rome. You know, specifically in the history field, I just think, why do another podcast about Germany, because there already is one, or about Rome, or about Egypt. You know, there already are those ones. You know, do something different and mix elements of your life as the podcaster within it, because then it becomes incredibly personal to the listener, as opposed to somebody really regurgitating a whole load of facts out of history books.
You need the personal element to make it human.
Absolutely.
So that takes us over into Mid-Atlantic then, leaving the historical aside for the briefest of moments and going into the more modern. But you, in order to really understand modern politics and modern life, you have to have at least some basis in history. What got you interested in doing the up-to-the-moment politics show Mid-Atlantic? And why to cover it from both the British and American perspectives?
Because that's kind of almost how I'm living my life at the moment now. I spend 6 months of the year in the States, and the other remaining time is split between Canada and the UK. So my life is completely biotional, if that's even a word. My life is mid-Atlantic. It absolutely is. And then being British and understanding the British political system and firmament, I can't help and understand it innately, because that's the country where I was born and brought up. I can't help but, when I'm in America, viewing American politics slightly with alien eyes. And the more I understand the history and the politics of the place, I'm equally in love and equally in awe of American politics. But it's also like a compare and contrast. You know, why is it that there's all this money in politics in America, but in Britain an MP can only spend something like about £45,000 to run to become an MP.
Well, because here, corporations are people.
Well, yeah, just the very fact that your Supreme Court had to rule on something like Citizens United makes no sense from a British perspective, because of course a corporation is not a person. But also, we have really strict laws around campaign donations. You cannot spend, if you are an MP, the equivalent to a congressman, and you're running for office, you cannot spend more than £45,000 to run, full stop. Because we say very clearly, and we understand that large amounts of money have a corrupting influence on politics. That's not to say there is no corruption in British politics, don't get me wrong, right? But the astronomical sums which are spent in American politics do not exist, not only just in Britain, but around the Western world. Australia has a similar rule, Germany has a similar rule, France, etc., etc. And it's one of the much more grotesque aspects of American politics, that overnight you could get rid of that amount of money in American politics, and your politics wouldn't collapse. But you know what? It'd be much more honest, and there'd be much more less vested political interest, and the power of lobbyists would collapse. It wouldn't disappear overnight, but it'd be much less, you know. And you can't, and that's just one of the things that you do, that you notice when you do this kind of compare and contrast with British and American politics, and it's a fascinating study.
It's so bizarre on this side of the ocean, where we have the concept that, oh, money is speech, and there are legit decent arguments for them. I don't agree with them, but they're good arguments, in as much that, well, it's my money, I should be able to spend it any way I want, and I should be able to contribute to this campaign. And a reasonable person on the other side says, well, yeah, that's pretty much true. And then, well, of course, my money should buy me influence with my representative. And again, you're like, well, I don't really agree with it, but I don't really see necessarily a legal precedent to say, no, you can't do that. Everyone should have the same access. And that's how we start falling down that pit, I think. And it, that part definitely goes back to, oh, I'd say probably the Andrew Johnson administration, that issue started. I don't know. The guy who stood against Reconstruction. But, oh, I could go off on that for a while. And this right here is not a politics show. So that being said, let's talk about the things that are genuinely important in life. Not just to crush your enemies and see them driven before you and hear the lamentation of their women, but what are you watching right now?
Interestingly, I've just finished watching The Walking Dead, like I think just about everybody else, that, you know, because it's the end of season finale. The only interesting thing about that is that one of the many podcasts that I do is a thing called Friday 15, where I interview friends and interesting people about whatever is on the top of my mind. And I interviewed Aaron, who does a rather excellent commentary podcast about The Walking Dead. I interviewed him today. So what am I watching? The Walking Dead, I don't think it's as good as it used to be. And that isn't just me being like an old fanboy. But I do think that what started off being an incredibly strong series has now become a pretty generic bit of TV drama, which is a bit of a shame. I'm watching The Affair, which isn't a particularly new show, but I've came to that late. But there's some amazing performances from the two leads, who actually are English. So Dominic West and Ruth Jones, I believe her name is, and that's the story of this writer and the affair that he embarks upon in Long Island, in some little seaside town, and then how that impacts their two families. Lots of twists and turns, really good psychological profiles, so that's really, really good. Can't wait for Game of Thrones. The truth of the matter is, I don't watch an awful lot of TV anymore. I listen to a whole load of podcasts. And I kind of like that because it allows me to do things and not arrest my attention all the time. So I'll be lying if I said I only watch those three things. I do watch more, but the truth of the matter is, Daniel, right here now, I can't remember. Well, in between traveling to Canada or back to the UK, I do try and watch the superhero stuff, but Iron Fist was too bad. I couldn't get past.
I couldn't get past the fourth episode.
Well, I think I got to episode 5 and I gave up. And trust me, I wanted to love Iron Fist. As a superhero obsessed child, Iron Fist was always pretty cool for me. Pretty cool, but no.
My biggest problem with it, I heard perfectly enumerated today on Fat Man on Batman,
which is a great show.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Mark Bernardin, yes, he's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
His take on it summed it up perfectly for me, because I couldn't quite place why it was bothering me. He has power of, some people would say, the power of the universe, or just at the very least all the focus power of his chi that he can then throw into his fist, or into turning himself into the ultimate fighting weapon. But if that's the case, why aren't we seeing more of that? The story is so slow moving and thin, and then for the martial arts themselves, it's cut within an inch of its life. It's edited, whereas you see that second episode of the first season of Daredevil, the hallway fight, where it's several minutes.
No, that is a thing of true beauty. It is a thing of true beauty. You know, absolutely. Absolutely. But this is the thing, though, and I know that a lot of people, the common consensus is that Luke Cage was good. I don't think Luke Cage was good. The premise of Luke Cage was yes, very compelling. You know, in a world where you have Black Lives Matters protesters, and where if you are an African American male, you are more likely, if you're stopped by the police, to be shot, regardless of whether you have a weapon or not, regardless of whether you hold your hands up or not. To have the premise of a black superhero who cannot be shot is so prescient and timely that it's a stroke of genius. So, but I would argue that those shows there were too many episodes in that series, and that actually the fundamental conceit that here is somebody who's wrestling with their superhero-dom was just a little bit too much. So I forget how many episodes there were in Luke Cage, but let's say for argument's sake there were 12
or 13.
They could have cut at least 5 of those out, and you'd add a much more, you would have had a narrative which was much more driven by traditional pacing. You could still have all the pathos of the character, but it just would have zipped along. Now, I think that what Netflix are doing is they're saying everything we do is basically a critical hit. So we can actually say to our directors, fill your boots. If you think this is 12 episodes worth of stuff, it's 12 episodes worth of stuff, because build it and they will come, you know. And actually what you're finding is there's a lot of flabbiness in the narrative, and actually it needs some stricter editing. It needs an executive editor to go, the executive producer to go, no. What you've written here is content for 7 shows. We're not going to puff it out to 11, to 12. We're going to condense it down to that. So all of these episodes are actually golden. They are strong. And in the first season of Daredevil, that's what you had. You didn't just have greatly paced episodes, but also you had the very elements of what you need in any kind of superhero genre. You had fight scenes. Those are incredibly important because it's superhero-dom. If you wanted a courtroom procedural drama, give us that. But no, it's superhero. So you need somebody punching somebody in the belly and somebody falling over. That's what we're paying our Netflix money for if you're watching Iron Fist. And not to have a man with a glowing fist, it can punch his way through a wall, you know, do it at least once or twice an episode. He's so selling a short as to be bizarre in the extreme.
And I think a big part of everyone's problem with it is when you see what that first season of Daredevil especially can do, the pacing being good, the fights being amazing, and then you actually go into a martial arts show and it's martial arts light. It's just incredibly disappointing. If the first season of Daredevil hadn't been shot the way it was, and further, if that, let's say that hallway fight, either A, wasn't there, or B, was cut like, let's say, more traditional network television, then I think Iron Fist would be disappointing people less.
Yes.
Not that people would be saying, yeah, I like it, of course. I think it would just be like, oh, you know, it's okay. It's leading towards the Defenders, though. It's a matter of, because we know how good it could be, we're even more upset by it because we're not seeing everything as it should be. Mm. We're not seeing it live up to its potential.
Absolutely. And I fell in love. So I'm a Marvel fanboy from way back when. Before I could actually really read, I was looking at comics. And I can remember when I couldn't read that this hero was called Captain America. I called him A-Man because he had an A on his mask. And and Hawkeye was H-Man because back in the comics, not the Marvel movie universe, Hawkeye, he had this mask, he had this cowl with an H on it. Anyway, I say all this to come on to Daredevil. And I came to Daredevil extremely late. So it was about 1989, 1990. And I knew there was a hero called Daredevil, but he always seemed to me like a poor man's Spider-Man. He swung around in Manhattan. He didn't really have any powers, which for me actually was a good thing. But I couldn't really discern what they were other than his radar sense. And there was... the famous run for Daredevil is Frank Miller, the writer, in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
That did all of that. I was aware of that body of work. But for me, there's a writer called Ann Nassetti who did, who with the artist John Romita Jr., they did from about episode 250 onwards. And I remember picking up that Daredevil issue because I love the artwork, and then to realize that John Romita Jr., who was drawing it, was the son of John Romita, who did Spider-Man in the late 60s, was just amazing for me. But I really understood Matt Murdock, and I understood his power set in that he's an ordinary guy. And what I loved was the fact that after slugging it out with some baddies during the night, he would turn up in court with a black eye.
Yes.
And I really got that sense from the Daredevil Netflix season, you know, that he always needed to be patched up. He was always, you know, he was always sporting some kind of injury when he was in Matt Murdock mode. And that was one of the many geniuses of that series, that he was a very earthbound, believable hero. His power set wasn't, you know, he's not a godlike Superman who can just float on high and have beams coming out of his eyes. You know, it didn't take much of a stretch of the imagination to think he could kind of do this. And then you saw that scene in that hallway. And that was like, that's what you're paying your Netflix money for. You know, you didn't need to watch any more of Daredevil. So, you know, hallway scene, bang, gone. That's it. Happy. I can die happy. I've seen a superhero rendered on the small screen in a way which makes physical sense, makes balletic sense in the way that he kind of moved around, and was truly something of awe actually to watch.
Well, three of my favorite elements of that scene are, one, in order to make it hurt more when he would punch somebody, he wrapped rope around his fists. Number one. And then you start seeing that rope shred. Number two, when he and one of the let's just call them goons because they were all nameless are getting really tired in the fight, they're both leaning against the wall in the hallway, staying just out of arm's reach of each other, probably broken. And then the third part, he used a microwave as a ranged weapon. You see the one guy go through the door, get up, go to run back in the door, and then the microwave comes flying out.
And I think this is one of the ways of which we've been sold short with Emmys and Oscars with superhero-dom, is that, don't get me wrong, a lot of it is pretty generic, you know, but in terms of special effects, in terms of choreography, in terms of makeup, you know, there are many areas which actually some of these superhero films and shows should be winning, and they don't even get a nod and a wink, and it's pure cultural snobbery. It does show you that by, and again, you know, it kind of comes back to what I was saying about podcasts. If you take a few risks, you absolutely will be rewarded, because overall, that X-Men franchise has ended up being a bit of a disappointment. It started off pretty good, and X-Men 2, that first scene with Nightcrawler going through the White House, I defy anybody, whether you love superhero-dom or not, not to say that's a beautiful bit of movie making. You understood Nightcrawler going through those walls, you know, to attack the president or to deliver his message to the president. And that was just brilliant. X-Men 3, I actually didn't mind at all.
Oh, really?
But maybe that was, I didn't mind it. But maybe I didn't mind it because it was the first time that we saw a total ensemble piece where there were lots of superheroes. But okay, well, we'll let that one go, because I know a lot of people will be judging me on the fact that I'm saying that I didn't mind it. I didn't say it was good. I'm saying I didn't mind it. But also,
well, this show is called Mike and Dan versus the Internet, so no matter what your opinion is, someone's going to hate you. So
okay, well, I know there are people hating on me even in Ghana right now for me saying that I actually didn't mind that film. But then when they rebooted it, X-Men First Class. Now, I am a little bit of a mod, and I don't know if that translates over in America too much, but mods were a subgenre of 60s pop music and fashion, specifically within the UK. So classically wore three-button suits, straight leg trousers, in a very kind of modern, modish way of kind of dressing. I've always thought that James Bond, all James Bond movies, should actually just be set in the 1960s. So you look back at those Sean Connery movies, stylistically, they're great in terms of the fashion,
oh, yeah,
etc. And I think when you looked at Roger Moore as James Bond in the 70s or Timothy Dalton in the 80s, they look cheesy. Whereas those 60s movies have never stopped looking great. The one exception to this is actually Daniel Craig, and the fact that definitely that kind of first movie where, you know, he looks great and he's made the role his own.
Oh,
but
my God, yeah.
Take Daniel Craig out of it just for now, right? James Bond should always just be set in the 1960s, because also you can be slightly cheesy and get away with it. And the fact that you've got Russians as, you know, as communists, so you have an ideological battle, you have the declining British Empire, you have great fashion, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What they should have done is always kept the X-Men in the 1960s, I would have said.
Mm.
X-Men First Class was brilliant because, again, you have this geopolitical backdrop, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also they just look so cool.
They did.
You know, remember that scene where Magneto is in Argentina and he's trying to find those Nazis, and, you know, he just looked cool. It was a cool scene. He had that roll neck and he just looked cool. And imagine also, you could also even do the Vietnam War around it. You know, you could have the assassination of both of the Kennedy brothers as the backdrop to all this superhero-dom. And the other X movies were just poor. The other Logan movies were just poor. And actually too much CGI.
Yeah.
Too much CGI. So that last film last year, Age of Apocalypse, and was just such a letdown. But And here's the thing. When you strip everything away, forget the CGI, and then you're just telling a great story, and it's on a human level, which goes to say what we're saying about Daredevil, then you have Logan. Yeah. You say, no, I'm going to show you somebody who has these extraordinary abilities, but they don't just define him. He's a person, and he's gone through a whole set of experiences which have made him who he is. And that is almost the traditional superhero arc, but I'm going to tell you this and him in his declining years, what's actually made him broken in a very human way, as opposed to some kind of scowling Batman. You know, physically, you understood he's getting old and how his powers would be declining because he's old. He has this history, and it's just a very simple story. And how powerful was Logan because of that? You know, didn't need all the ridiculous CGI and exploding buildings. This was somebody passing on his legacy onto the next generation. You know, it's a most beautiful father and daughter story, you know, told out half through the backdrop of the American / Mexican West, but it all the more powerful for taking out, you know, there's no Manhattan, there's no Gotham, there's no explosions. It was just a very simple, beautiful story. And it was a lovely way to sign off Professor X as well. And also, again, made sense out of him and his powers. If you have the ability to read minds, what's that going to do to you by the time you're 90? It's going to potentially screw yours up as well.
It's that thing of he was just using him as a metaphor for Alzheimer's in that way as well, of just you're going to break down. And in his case, take everybody else out with them. Spoiler alert. It was just absolutely heartbreaking, but it felt like, and I don't know what the actual budget was, but it felt like an independent movie, almost like a Quentin Tarantino film of let's do this on the cheap and make and do the little bits of special effects where you have to have them all have that much more impact.
You are right. You are right. It's very much like Till Dusk, Till Dawn, you know, visually, you know, with the desert and whatever. It felt very much kind of like that in a visual.
Yes. And I don't know what you felt about Days of Future Past. I thought that one was a pretty decent X movie. I liked it a lot more than Age of Apocalypse. Oh, my God, yeah. And I think I liked it more than X3 and certainly either of the Wolverine movies, Origins or the Wolverine.
Well, the other Wolverine movies, let's just forget about those.
Well, the first one apparently is now being is now considered no longer canonical because of Deadpool. It's like alternate. It's almost alternate universe. But that Days of Future Past, going back to your point of have a look that is iconic and can always work with that story, putting it into that one was in the early 70s for the most part. Oh my God, that just worked so very well.
Well, I'm trying to remember all the detail of that, and to be honest with you, I can't really remember, other than it starts off in the future and then they go back. And I just think that Mystique, she's kind of been undersold in all of these films, but suffice to say that me, again, being slightly old school with my Marveldom, I was always never really an X-Men fan. They were mutants, and I quite liked the ordinary person who had something extraordinary happen to them. So for all these superhero movies, I am Marvel Studios kind of through and through. And I understand Iron Man, Tony Stark, or Thor, and when he was Don Blake, I know he's not Don Blake anymore in the comics and in the movies, or Captain America, Steve Rogers, from absolutely from the ground up, in a way that I was never really so invested in the mutant X-Men franchise.
Yes.
You know, that was always a world within the Marvel world. You know, that mutants kind of did their own thing and they were kind of in the shadows and mutants fought other mutants. You know, whereas Spider-Man would fight the Vulture at the top of the Daily Bugle building in downtown Manhattan in, you know, up front and center, and everyone would see him. Whereas Magneto, or Magneto, depending on what your pronunciation is, would fight Professor X and the X-Men in some kind of subterranean bit of planet Earth, etc., because mutants were this, you know, subspecies of humanity. So, I struggle to remember the worst of the X movies, partly because, number one, they weren't that great, and number two, I never really was that invested in mutants, per se.
Well, There we have it on that. So how many presidents do you have left to go for your 10 American Presidents podcast?
Right. So 10 American Presidents is such a misnomer in lots of ways because there's going to be 11 presidents because, as explained in the last podcast,
you added Grant.
We added Grant. So we haven't done Obama. And that's only going to be the election of Obama. We can't judge his legacy anytime soon. Objectively dodge it anyway. We haven't done Kennedy, though that's in the works. We haven't done Jefferson. We haven't done Lincoln. We haven't done Reagan. We've got five more to do.
And for those, are you going with some of the more famous podcasters like Dan Carlin and Mike Duncan again? Are you going more for historians?
It depends on who wants to do it and who I would like to do it. It's very much a moving target. So Thomas Daly from the American Biography podcast is an amazingly smart guy and has this barrel-rich voice as well. He sounds like a proper man, unlike me. He sounds like some weedy, wimpy Brit. So he's going to be doing Kennedy. We need a couple of female voices. There is a professor who I'm petitioning to do Reagan, female professor at Harvard. But I'm sufficiently open. Maybe there'll be somebody in 6 months' time who's the media flavor of the month and who's got a couple of hours on their, you know, spare and can do a Teddy Roosevelt or something. I don't know. So it'll be a mixture of people who, whether they're in the media eye or whether they're a podcast or whether they're a historian, but as long as they can tell a good story, the chances are that they could actually do a good job.
And then the final big question that I have to ask you is, Star Trek or Star Wars?
I've always been Star Trek.
Oh, good man.
I've always been Star Trek. Considering that as a little kid, I was always into space and space travel. I got a telescope at the age of 8, and I was transfixed by looking at Mars through it and the moon, etc. I was always much more of a political nerd, even at the age of 8. So what I always loved about Star Trek was it was a universe which made sense. And it was also obviously about politics. You know, even at the age of 8, I understood this was a little bit more kind of grown up. Whereas Star Wars for me was always, even at the age of, and like that first movie came out when I was 9. So I'm ripe for being Star Wars crazy, but I just never have been. It was always slightly nonsensical. And obviously, though I didn't realize it at the time, but a 1930s serial. I didn't realize it at the time, but by the time I was like 12 or so, and I'd seen those old Flash Gordon serials from the 1930s, because those were replayed on British TV in the early 1980s, I realized, this is what this is. You know, everybody's in peril for one reel after another, and then they leap out of it. But being somebody who's visually fixated, the one thing which I always kind of admired was how cool that universe, the Star Wars universe, actually looked. So, you know, Darth Vader is wearing a German Nazi helmet. You know, the baddies are really bad, but they're very stylish in a Second World War kind of way. And somebody who loves classical antiquity, I do get the whole Republic becomes an empire thing. So it's a corruption of Rome. At the age of 9, did I get that? Absolutely not. But by the time I was, you know, 14, 15, I did. But no, I'm completely and utterly Star Trek. It's a universe which makes much more sense to me. I know, I understand who the Romulans are, who the Vulcans are, and they all make sense. The Klingons, they make sense. You know, Deep Space Nine, it's an outpost and it's a trading thing. Somebody's thought about this in a way which cohesively the sum parts are interrelatable on a geopolitical, on a historical level with the world as we understand it today. Whereas Star Wars is just, well, we're going to have some cute little things. We're going to call them Wookiees. We're going to have some walking robots. And if you think about it too much, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that was the problem with the prequels. George Lucas started making it let's try to explain the Force, where it was like, no, the mystical explanation given in the first one was enough.
Mm. No, listen, you know what? I think you're completely and utterly right. But, you know, just to wrap all of our conversations up, you know, I love history. I love politics, and politics is just history. But today, that's all politics actually is. And if you're a little nerd like me, and if you're a little only boy like I was when I was 8, 9, 10, and you're maybe reading a little bit too much into this, you can't help but just falling for Star Trek as to something which is much more grounded in reality, if you can say that about a whole universe of shows which are set out in the outer reaches of space.
Well, there you have that. Ladies and gentlemen, with us today has been nerd extraordinaire and politics guru, I'm going to call him, and podcasting raconteur Roy Field Brown. You can follow him on Twitter at Royfield, R-O-I-F-I-E-L-D. And do you want to promote anything here?
Okay. You've said it, but I'll say it again. I've got a new 10 American Presidents podcast out. It isn't your traditional history podcast show. What I try and create is cinema for the ears. Every Friday, soon to be twice a week, I produce an interview show called Friday 15, where I speak to friends and interesting people about just stuff. Each week is a completely and utterly different topic. So I'll speak to somebody about Marvel's superheroes. I'll speak to somebody about politics. I'll speak to an aid worker in Ghana, you know. And what I love about those shows is I just end up finding people who I just kind of fall in love with, really. Just speak to really interesting people about a whole range of topics. There is Mid-Atlantic, where I compare and contrast UK and US politics. And then I kind of do another thing called Dumdy Dum as well, which is, I won't go into now, but where I, with my co-host, we talk about our love of a UK soap called The Archers. But that's a whole universe in and of itself. So I produce a lot of stuff, and hopefully some of it is enjoyable.
Thank you so much for joining us, Royfield. And if you wouldn't mind signing off with us, we always say, may the Force be with you and also with you, treating it as, you know, Catholic Church. So If you wouldn't mind joining me, may the Force be with you.
But I thought we said that I was Star Trek and not Star Wars.
Well, in that case, peace and long life to you.
Live long and prosper.
Oh, that's even better. Thank you so very much for joining us.
No worries. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.